Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Balcom & Green PC, a full-service law firm with offices in Glenwood Springs, Aspen, and Basalt, providing advice and solutions for their clients' legal needs throughout Western Colorado for more than 60 years. Learn more at balcomgreen.com.
Good afternoon from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. This is Valley Roundup. Joining me today are Curtis Wackerly, the editor for the Aspen Daily News. Hi, Curtis. Thanks so much for coming in today. David Krause is here, the editor of the Aspen Times. Hi, David.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for coming in.
And thank you.
Aspen Public Radio's Elizabeth Stewart-Severy is also in the room. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Allison.
Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's get right into it. Secession. What's going to happen with the mid-valley, the part of the valley that is Eagle County and not Garfield or Pitkin County? Curtis, maybe I'll have you start with kind of just explaining what this group is trying to do.
Well, they're trying to do something that has been attempted before a couple different times. And it's really to correct sort of an – you could call it an error of map making. I don't know if anyone ever – made the mistake in the way we think of it, but it really doesn't make sense that there's this corner of Eagle County that's part of the Roaring Fork Valley. This dates back to a time when lines were drawn on maps with no relation whatsoever to watershed boundaries or geographical boundaries that make a lot of sense. It really goes back a long time. It's that line that's there.
Yeah.
Dates back to like the 1850s. And it goes all the way to the state line. And back, before these were even states, it like kept going into Utah and divided counties in Utah. I mean, it's
fascinating.
It's got an old history to it.
So this very minor part of the Roaring Fork Valley is voting for issues in Eagle. This very minor part has to drive all the way around from Glenwood
Springs.
Well,
it's not really a minor part. I mean, I've heard estimates, 10, 12,000 people live.
Wow.
Live,
yeah.
It's a major part of our community. If it's the heart of the Mid Valley. There's
sure.
parts of the Mid Valley that are Pitkin and Garfield counties as well. But it's a really significant portion of the valley.
I'm glad you corrected me. Of course, listeners from the Mid-Valley, I'm not trying to say that you're minor. The thinness, you can drive from Pitkin County into Eagle County into Garfield County within 15 minutes, right?
Yes, correct.
So it's a narrow geographical portion, and they're making decisions for things that are really affecting the Vail Valley.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I think it's an interesting point. I believe the last number I heard from a commissioner, Eagle County commissioner, was about 8,000. So roughly 8,000 to 10,000 is the number. But I think it's the development that's going on over there is what, Eagle County, I mean, why would they want to give that up, right? And so I think that's their push. But it just is the growth. I think the people in that part of the valley really feel, like we said, disconnected. They have a meeting, what is it, Curtis, once every 7 weeks that they come over, the Eagle County commissioners have their meeting. So it's an interesting dynamic, but it is a really weird, and the whole, that whole when you get into Carbondale and then all of a sudden you're going back over to Redstone and you're back in in Pitkin County.
You drive
as the crow flies.
Cross five different county lines between here and McClure Pass.
Yeah, it's really funny.
It's really – yeah, it is strange.
And David, you hit the nail on the head. This is pretty much a direct reaction to that tree farm approval.
I think it probably brought it up again. Like Curtis said, it's been up in the – been tried a few times, but I think – with the boom in the state and the boom in the valley and where people are trying to live right now, I think it's really made it even more under the microscope.
Well, this proposal has come up in the past, right?
Same group has been in existence for 20 years, it sounds like.
Really?
And I think there is sort of frustration that arises, having been one of those people who lives in that part of the valley. Wyatt Orm, our reporter here, always calls it the slice of the Roaring Fork Valley, and it seems like that's very much what it is. It just kind of cuts in the middle there. And really, when you get called for jury duty, you're looking at a full day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is significant that as a voter in Eagle County, I was not nearly as informed on some of the issues that were on the ballot as I was on the issues that I couldn't vote on in Pitkin County. So I do think it goes beyond just development.
Okay.
There is some like sense of cohesion in where you live and you work and where your voice is going, essentially.
It would make a lot more sense to have your elected representatives coming from your same community. But I guess, first of all, Eagle County only has three commissioners, unlike Pitkin County, where we have five. Mm-hmm. So the way the districts are drawn, apparently it'd be very, you'd have to get people on the other side of the mountains voting for a candidate from here, which, you know, how likely is that going to be to ever happen? And yeah, you're kind of stuck without local representation. And I think while it is bigger than one particular development proposal, mm-hmm. development brings it to the fore unlike anything else. In fact, I believe some of these prior issues, you know, when this has come up, I think in the 90s, there was an effort to do this. It was right when that big strip mall with the City Market and the Movie Land was all being developed, because that was coming through as an unincorporated Eagle County development. And it was the same kind of thing where people were saying, hey, we feel like we should have a little tighter control on some of this than maybe the Eagle County commissioners were willing to exercise. And that's exactly what you saw with the tree farm. I mean,
that puts development in such perspective. I mean, that's City Market Strip. I can get my Thai food and my nails done and my groceries all in one mm-hmm. spot. That's a key development in my mind as to that community. So that there was, you know, people mm-hmm. who were very against it at the time. The cycle keeps on turning.
And that development was central to the growth in the Mid-Valley, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. the people who are concerned about Mid-Valley exploding now, I think, have seen it with development there pretty consistently.
So why Pitkin County? Of the two, you know, the Eagle is between mm-hmm. Pitkin and Garfield County. If they just want to be part of the Valley, especially when it comes to the school districts, to me it seems like just as logical, at least it should be part of the conversation, that they think about getting annexed into Garfield County instead.
Well, half of Basalt is Pitkin County
already.
Yeah,
so I think
move,
it's
yeah.
like mm-hmm. uniting the town of Basalt in one county.
And then
maybe
pulling
Elgin. I'm sure you're going to – we actually got a call in the newsroom from a guy who was like, who says we want to be in Pitkin County? We want to – you know, they're more favorable toward Garfield County. I mean, this brings – you know, kind of gets to the bottom line here of whether or not this is actually feasible and how you go about doing it. At the very least, it seems to me – Eagle County, all the residents of Eagle County, all the people in Vail and Edwards and Eagle would, and the Roaring Fork Valley would have to vote in the affirmative in the majority to let this go.
Okay.
So how feasible is that?
And you know, your article brought up it might not even be as easy as a vote. They are trying to get something on the November ballot, but
right.
there's a whole another process that's lined up.
Yeah, and I've always there's some question of whether or not you have to get 50% of the people in the affected area to sign a petition, which would be extremely difficult.
4,000.
You know, it's, you know, it's one thing to go out and get 600 signatures for your ballot initiative, but we're, you know, if there's 8,000 people, go and get 4,000 signatures.
Wow.
You know, that would be really difficult. But apparently, it's debatable as to whether or not you actually need to do that. Our story said an example of when DIA was developed, the airport, there was some sort of trading of county boundaries, and it apparently went down without having to do that. So who knows? I think the lawyers are cracking open their state statute and state constitution to see what they say here, because you know it hasn't happened in a while. You don't see too much, but you know, dividing and subdividing counties was a thing that happened quite a bit back in the old days. That's why we're here in Pitkin County, which used to be a part of Gunnison County, which is why we have that line in the first place.
So it's not population-based. It's not part of the census every 10 years where a county line might be redrawn. It seems like it's been that way since 1880, so kind of a rhetorical question. David, also, I wonder if you and your reporter, Scott Condon, have talked about this. Of the group who's trying to get this done, the name Tim Whitsitt caught my eye. Is that a Jackie Whitsitt spouse?
Yes, yes.
So as the Basalt mayor for this, do we know that?
She, I would think so, but she's recusing herself in most of these situations because of the, you know, because of the whole idea. And I know that Jackie's, you know, was on council previously and has seen this kind of develop before. I will say, having talked to Eagle County officials, the treasurer, some of the commissioners, you know, they try to make that tie to the Valley. It's, you know, they don't see it as out on an island. They're trying to bring it back in, and, you know, they send us regularly, you know, op-eds or letters to the editor to run in the Times so they can kind of have their voice in the Valley and kind of make that inclusion a little bit stronger.
And your sense is that they're hoping the secession does not happen.
I can't imagine they would want anything like that. It's like we said, based on the development and the tax base, especially.
You'd think so, but apparently Pitkin County and Eagle County studied this 16 or 18 years ago, and Pitkin County determined it wouldn't it wouldn't be worth it. The tax base was not big enough to because, you know, you have to provide the services then. That, right. You know, it costs you money as Picken County to now provide services to all these people. And in 2000, at least, it was determined that it wasn't worth pursuing from Picken County side. Now, as we all know, there's been a lot of growth that's happened since then. So maybe that has changed.
I think it'll be interesting. This might be, you know, something for the next few years. I can't imagine it could get rushed onto a ballot. But it's certainly another whole conversation that's made that population growth and all that business down there a little more intriguing.
Well, Curtis, you're right. We spend a lot of time talking about a few things. It's already time for a break. We'll be right back. You are listening to Valley Roundup from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Joining me here in the studio to put this week's news in perspective for us today are Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio's environment reporter, David Krause, the editor of the Aspen Times, and Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News. Thanks for listening. Elizabeth, you watched a meeting yesterday about the Red Mountain property donation, and Curtis, I think you broke this story open. Where are we in this process right now? What did you see?
It's gone through the first reading with Picken County commissioners, and on that first reading, it went forward pretty much without any hitches. It sounds like while the Red Mountain Homeowners Association doesn't have 100% support of this land donation, the commissioners, there's some concern about rockfall mitigation, and I guess the county has not fully completed its investigation into how significant that mitigation will be if it will wind up being super expensive.
Okay.
So they do still have an out if they don't want to accept the donation, but at this point it's moving forward.
Curtis, what's in it for these landowners if they do donate the land? Is there a sneaky cost that they're hoping that they don't have to deal with someday?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, there's certainly there's this one particular rock that's sitting up there. That
literally, like one boulder.
Like, it's bigger than a boulder.
Okay. You know, they called it like the pirate rock.
That sounds so cool. Of course I want that to be public land.
And so if this were to come down, it could cause a lot of damage. But you can say that about almost anywhere in this valley, that there's some rock somewhere that may, in the course of geologic time, roll down the mountain and cause some sort of property damage. We think we're at the point where these homeowners are actually giving the county over $70,000 to pay a contractor to come in and, you know, like chisel down the rock and like carry it away
chisel
in buckets
pirate rock.
to reduce the risk. You know, I think what's in it for the homeowners is this is undeveloped land. It currently sits and exists as open space. For a long time, the subdivision has been there for 50 years, and it's always – this land is common area. It's up at the top of Red Mountain. There's never been much thought given to maybe this could be developed, but I think we're at a point in our valley where sites that people didn't really think were particularly viable for development before are now seen as viable because there's people who have so many resources and are willing to go through the process to do this. I think there definitely are homeowners up there who thought, hey, let's just sell this, and you know, if it sells for $10 or $12 million, and then we all get some cash in our pockets. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people are like, well, no, we don't really want to have to look at this house. We don't want to deal with the impacts. And I think there was some altruism there where they wanted to just, you know, giving it to the county is a mechanism to lock it up forever. Okay. and preserve it.
Jerry Murdoch, who's the president of the Homeowners Association, also spoke quite a bit about like the protecting some of the environmental features up there. Apparently there's a bear den and it's used by wildlife, and he says that's a real concern for him, that he'd like to maintain that kind of wildness up there. And I think that probably is a draw to homeowners up there, and just sort of if you have environmental leanings anyway.
And I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that 55 acres could have been broken into four parcels as well. So you could have had some kind of engineering feat these days where, you know, they can put a road now where you would think unusual. So versus one or two or three, they could add even more than that up there. So
it's a way of making sure they don't have four new neighbors.
Right. Four new neighbors, okay. or even one.
Okay.
Yeah.
would they then use this? What are the commissioners talking about? Would it become recreation or trails at all for public use, or it would stay just for those environmental uses?
Yeah, it's about protecting the view plane.
Okay.
So keeping the top of Red Mountain free of big homes, and it would fall into Picken County open space and trails land management.
Okay.
But it sounds like the management would be primarily things like maybe some weed control if that had to happen, the rockfall mitigation. It would be pretty minimal.
Yeah, they're
management.
Saying no public trails.
Okay. So what do the members of the public gain or lose? I mean, is this something that affects us all?
We just won't have to look at a big house up there with a bunch of retaining walls, and we'll sleep better at night knowing that the bear in the den has not been disturbed.
Of course we will. Wonderful. Let's move on.
Nice perspective, Chris. That's awesome.
Carolyn Zachariasen had a story about the teachers protesting in Aspen, and our reporter Wyatt Orm spoke with some in the Lower Valley today. So teachers statewide want more pay and their pension filled out, and they're taking action. What's happening here in the Valley?
Well, I think you're going to see this morning, Friday morning, the teachers at Aspen were going to gather at the middle school and do their walk in there. There will be a few of them who go down and take a day off. I think after the student protest last week, students, you know, and teachers realize that at some point. Plus, we have such good local support here. And I think that's a big differentiator with some of the communities. When we see that we're down $2,000 per pupil spending, we don't really see that here because we do have such great support through the Education Foundation. And so I think that's also a player in this. But I think, you know, it's part of that whole national movement. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot on my Facebook feed, because I lived in Oklahoma for such a long time. I had a lot of teacher friends down there who spent days and days at the state capitol down there. And you see it going on in Arizona. I think they were calling for, you know, 10,000 to 20,000 teachers in Arizona at the state capitol down there. So I think it's, you know, Red for Ed movement is gaining ground. And people are just, you know, it's finally that thing of, are we going to commit as a state to figuring out, you know, the negative balance and Tabor and all these things that preclude us from trying to actually put some money and invest into education? But I think you'll see the teachers here see it. You know, they did a bit of a walk-in, sit-in last Monday, Monday. And so, you know, I think they keep that in mind. But it'll be interesting how many people are there Friday morning.
Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, former teacher, spent a lot of your time and resources and skills on public education. Are we at a reckoning?
You know, I'm not sure about right now, but I will say that the fact that Aspen schools do have local support is outstanding and amazing. And I think most teachers would tell you that that's great. But it comes with the caveat that it is not consistent. Having support from a private foundation in a public school, I think, introduces some interesting conflicts. And I don't think that's an ideal situation. I think probably a lot of teachers at the schools would say that's really not ideal. And that the values of public education do come from a different funding source than a private foundation. With, you know, certainly the caveat that we do see tremendous support for education in Aspen, in the Roaring Fork Valley, that goes beyond just that private foundation. I mean, taxpayers in Aspen have supported all kinds of mill levies and sales taxes and all kinds of things to support education in this valley. But I don't think that it's quite the same issue as what teachers are looking for and asking for right now.
Is it fair to put you on the spot a little bit more and just talk about how our country values public education? I mean, there's been so many other movements that have happened within the last couple of years where we're talking about immigration, we're talking about workplace harassment, we're talking about things that that the whole country is finally saying, like, this has been a problem for a long time, let's talk about it now. Is public education one of those?
You know, I don't know about nationwide. I think certainly there's a push to understand where we place our values and where we're spending our money. And I think that that's a conversation we have pretty regularly in the country. I think what's happening now is maybe this larger sense of civil disobedience, of using your voice to stand up for things. I don't think that teachers tend to be a group of people. I'm sorry for stereotyping here, but they don't tend to be a group of people that like is up for a huge fight. You know, I think as David mentioned last week, students walked out for gun control. There are probably teachers who are feeling the pressure of like, IB testing is happening soon and it's the end of the year and we've got to get through this curriculum and there are important things to do. And I think there's real pressure on teachers every day. I think also keeping the larger picture in mind is something that's really important, and kind of trying to find the right venue and the right way to use your voice and to speak up for what you believe in when it comes to public education. I also have a sense that there are a lot of teachers who are taking personal days to go to the state capitol. I think the challenge with that is when you make that decision, you know that you're leaving behind kids who are then going to need to go somewhere, and other teachers are going to have to cover for those kids. And you're essentially putting a burden on your colleagues and your coworkers in a system that's already pretty stressed to speak up. It's not perfect.
Yeah, and I think that's why you see the metro area districts are just having to shut down because you don't have enough substitutes, you know, in a Jeffco, in a DPS, you know, the largest, you know, the couple largest Jeffco, Dougco, and Denver public schools. And that's why, you know, DPS tried to do just a half a day. And then earlier this week, they said, you know what, that's not even going to work. We're just going to close it down. So I think as of Wednesday or Thursday, there were more than a dozen, almost, you know, 20 districts statewide that were just closing down.
And that is an interesting dynamic where you are burdening the thing you're trying to help. Mm-hmm. In the same way we're like, you know, victims, you better be the one speaking up. Like, why is it that we have to cancel classes in order to fight for classes, kind of thing?
Yeah.
Curtis, there's some updates to the Castle Creek Bridge detour that will start on Monday.
This is the world's most complicated detour program. Still are going to have a hard time reaching the Hickory House.
That, I want to talk about the Hick House.
Yeah.
What I want to know if
you know what's great? I actually live in this area. And so there's whole sections of what's normally Highway 82 that have no traffic on them. I was coming home the other day, and one of my neighbors' two kids were playing in the middle of the S-curves.
That's awesome.
We need a picture of that for posterity.
But yeah, so we've been with this project now for almost a month. This has been widely touted, a lot of hype on both sides. But we're about to get into this new phase where the traffic is going to have to be rerouted on Power Plant Road, which is a different scenario than what you have now. The traffic's being diverted through the West End, but you're still going over that bridge, one lane in each direction. Now what's going to happen for the next – until they go on the pause, the high season hiatus starting in mid-June, the inbound traffic is coming in on the bridge. The outbound traffic is diverting through the West End, going down to Smuggler Street – under Power Plant Road, which is this windy, curvy road that's an alternate exit of town, back up Cemetery Lane, turn left, then you turn right, and you're back on the highway. And so this is a much more impactful diversion than what we have now.
Yeah.
And it's going to mean that if there's, you know, significant traffic, if, you know, once the roadway starts to exceed capacity, there will definitely be longer delays.
Okay.
If you can, take the bus, because the buses still get to go out on the bridge. So they'll
outbound buses get to use
outbound
the bridge.
Buses still get to use the bridge,
and they'll be doing the little stops.
They'll stop the inbound traffic. The buses will stage. You'll get, you know, three or four of them there. They'll go through. Then the inbound traffic will keep going.
Which also means the impacts to inbound traffic will be more significant than they are right now.
Correct.
Too.
Because that was the issue the first week. I was taking the bus down to Glenwood and listening to the scanner at about 3:30 on a Thursday. I think the first week, and God bless them. The raft of drivers were almost beside themselves because they couldn't cross over in the West End, but then also the backups from getting into the roundabout, going back up to the Arc, they were backed up, going back to the hospital. And so now that we're, you know, we don't have as many people in, we're in the off season, maybe that will be a little different, but it is that trickiness of that letting the buses through and stopping it back on both on the inbound as well.
So this is just such a beautiful opportunity because Roaring Fork Valley residents get to both complain and talk about traffic in one breath. I'm wondering, with these updates, or if you heard from how the public open houses went, if there's still kind of that anger that we saw right when the project began, or if people get it now?
I'm sure there's still some anger out there. We haven't really had a letter about it in maybe 4 or 5 days. I'm sure one will be there when I get back to the office. I'm sure once, you know, the backups get worse, and especially as we get closer to Memorial Day weekend, you might hear some more protests.
You know, the bike commute has been okay. There is a detour. It's consistent. You can count on it. Yep. There's no traffic.
Yeah, riding your bike is always the best.
If you can get out of a car at some point and jump onto a bike, and I know WeCycle is going to be starting up soon. And is
hey Curtis, what's new with WeCycle this year?
Well, they're going to be free to the user, not free because the taxpayers are paying for expanding this WeCycle
service.
That's
a good caveat. So the city of Aspen pays into some of the cost of running WeCycle. RAFTA pays into some of the cost of running WeCycle. Of course, us, the taxpayers, are making up those budgets. Mm-hmm. How does WeCycle keep getting all this public money?
I think they've done a good job at making their pitch, and they have the numbers to back it up. Every year they've grown in the amount of rides they provide. Adding it to the Mid-Valley, I think, was huge because
It seems like they think of themselves as a leg of the public transportation that is offered. But I am curious, for RAFTA, who is trying to sell a tax hike on a ballot measure this November, for them to be paying toward WeCycle unless they really believe that is part of their product.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the interesting part is that they are strategic about and are really paying attention to the data that they're getting. So if they have a station that isn't producing, then they're going to move it.
I have a question. Are there WeCycle stations on the far side of the bridge?
So this has been they were going back and forth on this. The program starts on the 1st, which I think is Tuesday, right? Mm-hmm. That's when the WeCycle stations are all going to be out.
Yes.
And, you know, up until, you know, the end of last week, they were still having conversations about where they're going to site some of these stations. So there is going to be one at the roundabout. The long-term plan is to have some WeCycles out at the ABC, at Buttermilk, and at Burlingame. So maybe you could park your car there if you really wanted to jump on a bike and ride the rest of the way into town. And they would love to offer e-bikes.
Yeah, I was going to say that might exceed the 30-minute limit for some people.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, of course, we're going long, so we don't get to talk about the Pickens County elections, but those, we have a little bit of time before they happen, so I'd love to have you back and discuss some of those, or that the Snowmass Tourism Board is kind of okay with pot sales in Snowmass. You just have to hide them a little. I would love instead
that's
to...
That's an interesting comment, but the double negative language in that is beautiful.
Just, just go around the
We don't
corner.
Want to say we like them, but we want to say we're okay with them.
That's
as
amazing.
Long as we make it, you know, back around the corner, like Curtis just said. Although I do kind of like that idea of getting it off the ground level in the village. I do think that
get
is somewhat
higher.
Smart. Yeah, exactly. There you go.
Well, I do want to end then on Farmer Jack, because I know that was an important story to a lot of your readers, David. Can we just pay a little tribute to the man we lost this week?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. You know, a lot of people knew who he was in town. I was surprised how many people responded to that story, quite frankly, but he was such a presence in the valley for anybody who went to a farmer's market or anything like that. He was only here for 10 years, but quite the character. You know, he just wanted, like Curtis said, he just wanted people to connect with their farmer and make that sense of, okay, this is where my food is coming from. It's clean and it's fresh and it's not in a big mill somewhere or organic or genetically modified. You know, it is organic. It is, you know, from start to finish. So I think that, you know, to his credit was the passion that he had that he helped kind of accelerate that idea.
And we were lucky to have him. You've been listening to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Joining me today are Curtis Wackerly, the editor for the Aspen Daily News, David Krause, editor of the Aspen Times, and Aspen Public Radio's Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. Thank you all for spending some time talking about the week's news.
That was fun. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Allison.
Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News. Thanks for listening.